From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, whoever you may be across the nation around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, electronic harassment with Roger Tulsis. Hey, by the way, if you're into technology, we are very happy to finally announce that our website is now optimized for mobile device users, specifically for the iPhone and Android platforms. BlackBerry, not quite ready yet. Now you're able to connect to most of the offerings of the Coast to Coast website on your phone in a very quick and streamlined fashion. And if you are a Coast Insider, you'll have our great subscriber features right on your phone, including the ability to listen to live programs and stream previous shows. No special app is necessary to enjoy that new mobile site. Simply visit coasttocoastam.com on your iPhone or Android browser. And since we're just launching this service tonight, if you encounter any glitches, just send us some feedback at coasttocoastam.com. That's feedback at coasttocoastam.com. Our staff will be working and tweaking this over the next week or so. The death toll from an outbreak of killer bacteria centered on Germany jumped to at least 30 on Thursday as the EU and Russian leaders got ready to crisscross swords over Moscow's ban on EU vegetables. The latest victim was a 57-year-old man in Frankfurt who last month traveled with his wife to the northern city of Hamburg, an epicenter of the outbreak. So far, more than 2,800 people were also ill in at least 14 countries with this E. coli poisoning, which in severe cases can lead to death. In a moment, Charles Osman joins us, and he's going to react to this story. And believe me, what he has to say will frighten you. At coasttocoastam.com, we have an Instapoll going about, do you believe the new outbreak of E. coli in Germany is? And we give you four possibilities. So far, 74% of you believe it's a laboratory-produced toxin deliberately released. Go register your vote now at coasttocoastam.com Instapoll. Health officials say 39 people have been sickened from a salmonella outbreak spread through handling of baby chicks or ducklings. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says the cases are spread through 15 states. Ohio had the most cases with 8. The other states, Georgia, Indiana, Kentucky, Michigan, Maryland, Minnesota, North Carolina, New York, Pennsylvania, Tennessee, Virginia, Vermont, Wisconsin, and West Virginia. No deaths reported, but at least 9 were hospitalized. People who got sick ranged from small children to elderly adults. Nearly half were kids, ages 5 and under. A mail order hatchery, apparently identified as the source of the infected birds. The CDC has not released the name of that hatchery. The attendee list of the Bilderberg is still pretty much the only thing that is not as a closely guarded secret, as 120 of the world's richest and most powerful people meet behind closed doors, this time in Switzerland. Award-winning documentary filmmaker and host Alex Jones with me on the line here. Alex, what do we know so far?
Well, I've got boots on the ground. Two of my reporters, Paul Watson and Aaron Dykes, are on the ground, and they had a fake bomb scare. Even the London Guardian is confirming the report that we first broke about the bomb scare. They pushed our reporters back, actually wouldn't let us have our car for about 2 hours there in the resort town of St. Moritz in the high mountain areas of the Swiss Alps. They also put up more than a 200-yard-long giant white shower curtain for the world leaders, including U.S. politicians who are attending this. And we've gotten from Jim Tucker's Inside Mold the agenda of Bilderberg 2011. Number one, they want to continue the bailouts that are just taxpayer-transferred money to the private megabanks that created the derivatives. They want to expand these revolutions they're funding in the Middle East into a full-scale regional war as a political distraction from what they're doing. They want to continue to raise gas prices to further bankrupt the economy so they can then pose as the saviors with their globalist world government solutions and the new Bancor world currency that the IMF and World Bank are pushing. They're also looking at who they want to replace as the new IMF chief that Dominique Strauss-Kahn has had to step down.
And there's talk it could be Hillary.
There's talk it could be Hillary. That's in the news today. Times of London, also the Mexican finance minister. But this is directly from a mole inside. They also are talking about wanting to crack down on the alternative media and are specifically angry that their electronic Berlin Wall, their news blackout, their blockade of Bilderberg News is imploding. Just 5-6 years ago, George, you were one of the only national programs that would even talk about it. Remember, previous to that, this didn't exist. You were insane. In fact, just 4 years ago, the New York Times, reviewing the film New World Order, said that I was crazy, or 3.5 years ago in Chantilly, Virginia, yeah. and that I was there imagining that the Bilderberg people were there. So incredible things that are happening, and our reporters are there on the ground.
Keep us updated, Alex.
I will.
Thanks, Alex Jones. About 200,000 Citibank credit card customers, might be you, in North America, have had their names, account names, numbers, email addresses stolen by hackers who broke into the Citi's online account site. Citigroup said it discovered the account information for about 1% of its credit card customers that had been viewed by hackers. Citi has more than 21 million credit card customers in North America. The New York-based bank, which is discovering the problem during a routine monitoring, did not say exactly how many accounts were breached. Citi said it was contacting those customers. Sections of downtown Detroit lost power Thursday after high demand during the previous day's 90-degree heat caused parts of the city's aging municipal power system to simply fail, prompting crews to cut power to City Hall and a convention center to prevent the entire system from crashing. The Midwest and floating out to the east are getting bombarded with severe heat. Mitch Batras from Earth Changes Media with us. And first of all, congratulations. You are expecting a baby with your wife. How about that? You have to call the kid Storm.
Oh, wow. I'm going to keep that in mind. Let me run that by the wife.
That's right. You're going to have to do that. Hey, what's going on with this high heat now, Mitch?
Well, I mean, look, it's devastating. I mean, there's no way around it. It's horrible. But let's keep things in perspective. This is what people need to know. This is produced by the National Climate Data Center and NOAA. So this is the go-to. These are the guys who make the rules, if you will. Now, let me give you two definitions. One definition is record. What is a record? A record is warmest and coldest based on a 120-year period. That's all it means. So most of it is from 1895 to 2006, but generally a 112-year period. That's what they call a record. That is an extremely short period of time. So when you hear record-breaking, it's really relatively short. Now, the heat that's going around now, certainly it's terrible and suffering, but it pales compared to how hot it's been in the past. For example, New York, and it's the Northeast that most people are talking about.
Right now, yeah.
The record high in New York was 108 degrees. That was 1926. Washington, D.C., the record high was in 1874, and that was 102, so that was matched. The highest temperature ever was in 1913, was 134 degrees. In Texas, 1936, 120 degrees. So, let's keep this in perspective. It can get a lot higher, and notice the dates that I mentioned. I'm talking the 1930s. Of course, what happened in the 1930s? The Dust Bowl. What also happened in the 1930s was solar cycle 17.
Exactly.
Which was its apex, was right around 1936, 1937. In other words, the highest point, the maximum of that solar cycle.
The sun, Mitch, is starting to truly heat up, as you well know. Check it out, earthchangesmedia.com. A bloodthirsty pack of dogs has killed about 100 animals in the past few months while eluding law enforcement and volunteers in the northeastern part of the state of Washington. The killing started in late March. They've occurred in a wide area of mountains and valleys. Most recently, the dogs killed a 350-pound llama. They've also killed goats and other farm animals as well. Two Canadians died instantly in a freak accident when a car hit a 440-pound black bear sent the animal flying straight through the windshield of an oncoming vehicle. The bear's body hit a 25-year-old driver and a 40-year-old man sitting behind her and then shot right out the back window. The bear also died. Unbelievably freak accident. A group searching for the proof of Bigfoot is alert for reports along the Missouri River where they believe heavy flooding could disrupt the legendary creature's normal comings and goings. Rachel Luffman from the Bigfoot Field Researchers Organization with us. Rachel, I know that area pretty well, and this is a strong possibility. If Bigfoot exists along there, those floods are going to chase him out.
Absolutely, that's a distinct possibility. We've noticed over the years that Sasquatches always do tend to stick close to fresh water, and especially rivers. They tend to use rivers as sort of roadways as they travel along. So it's definitely possible that all of this flooding could displace a few and maybe make them venture out further than they normally would, and it could increase sightings.
Have we had any sightings to date because of this?
I don't know of any to date, but it's definitely a possibility, and we're keeping our eyes open, and anyone who lives, you know, close to these rivers who are flooding should keep their eyes open.
All right, very good. Thank you, Rachel. That story came to us, by the way, a friend of ours, Kevin Killeen, who's a radio broadcaster in St. Louis. Up next, we're going to be talking with Charles Ostman about this E. coli situation in Germany. Can it happen here, and what's behind it? We'll get Charles' take on Coast to Coast AM. Charles Ostman, of course, been on the program a number of times. He is an expert in strategic research and analysis, and also an expert in renewable energy, bioremediation, advanced materials, transportation. We're going to bring him on to talk about this situation, about this E. coli, horrible situation happening in Europe right now, perhaps filtering into some other areas as well. Charles, set the scene for us a little bit, though. Give us some background about this.
Sure, and that's a fair question, and a little bit of history, if I may, just to kind of give a reference point. I got into this realm of research really because I'm a material science. That's kind of my primary area of interest. And going back 20 years now, many people, myself included, have always looked at biology as a kind of a manufacturing system. In other words, if you have an interest in manufacturing nanoscale objects or moving pieces of metal around a surface, for instance, or constructing some kind of a complex device, whatever it might be, traditional manufacturing methods, of course, are very difficult and expensive, and nature has been doing this for billions of years. And so many of the early people that were interested in doing these kinds of things, the first thing we looked at was biological solutions. Can we use viral components and certain types of bacteria and so forth to construct things and to make particles or to move objects around, that sort of thing? And that's kind of how we first got started in this. Later, that very quickly evolved into the area of sensors and detectors and different kinds of things that eventually evolved into the role of biopathogen detection, that sort of thing. A lot of my comrades and myself spent many, many hours solving certain kinds of problems along these lines. And I'll progress to the current moment and say that I do actually still work with a couple of think tanks. One's called the Millennium Project, headed by Jerry Glenn. In fact, you had Jerry Glenn on the air, I think, a few months ago, and I was very appreciative of that. And we work on this series we call the 15 Main Challenges of the World, and amongst those, of course, are strategic challenges that would have significant effect on world economies, that kind of thing. And so in that perspective, we look at a world now where it's back in the days of the Cold War, you know, you had the Soviet Union versus the U.S., and you had very large-scale military projects. I worked on some of these myself, and it was a kind of a simpler world at that time, although during that time, that was the beaming edge of this kind of biowarfare development program on both our sides. But now we live in an asymmetrical world, which means that a very small group of people, even just a handful, and you had a guest on the other night, Stephen Quayle, who made mention of this, and I give him credit for having at least part of his facts right, because he was correct in this regard. Unlike, say, a nuclear device, which requires a tremendous amount of investment, very complex machinery, and very skilled people to know how to do this kind of thing, that's a different story than putting together something that's biological that can actually be done in a small building, a handful of people,
sure,
of equipment.
You know a little bit about chemistry and biotechnology, you're on your way.
And you're on your way, and the tools, the actual machine, the equipment that one can purchase off the shelf from any number of biolab equipment suppliers, yes, absolutely true. In fact, there's a lot of you know, college kids now, they call it biohacking. They actually do sort of mix and match DNA as a kind of a hobby almost. I mean, that's how far it's come. So, I mean, in a way, let's look at it this way. I mean, mutation happens constantly, and I won't go into a bunch of details about transposons and linkages and that kind of thing, but there are certain ways that if you know where you are looking in a certain genome and you know which particular transposon to activate and how to enzymically replace one chunk of protein with another, that sort of thing, it's a pretty rote process. And so what you're really doing is you're creating sort of like synthetic mutation to create some new kind of object, some new kind of living organism. But the real sort of breakthrough in this area, if you want to look at it that way, is an emerging science called synthetic biology. And again, just allow me to give a little background. For years and years and years, I mean, I remember back in the, you know, early 80s, to synthesize one protein as a process was a major deal. I mean, that was a really big challenge.
It's huge,
to actually
yeah.
build a single protein. It could be done. Nowadays, you can replicate proteins of all kinds just almost automatically. You punch in some software code and you have the right kind of machinery and out comes the protein of your choice. So the roadmap to make this possible, there's something called the BioBrick protocol, which is kind of like an operating system for building artificial organisms. And that stems from another area of science called in silico biology. And just really briefly, in silico biology is the ability to model complex physiological systems on a computer. In fact, some of the slides that, and by the way, once again, I have to thank Lex for being extremely patient, and he's a great guy. At the last nanosecond, he was editing the photos, and he got them up there, and you've got a great webcam.
Oh, he's fantastic.
I want to give a thumbs up. He's always been really good. Anyway, so one of those slides, you'll see an actual screen dump from a typical, kind of like a schematic, if you will, of a living system. And this is how it's done. You start by trying to isolate and categorize different components within, let's say, a bacteria or some other kind of organism, and you literally build up like a schematic of it in a computer model. You run the model, you kind of get to the point where you say, okay, we think this is going to work or behave in a certain kind of way in some physiological process. And then from that, you translate that into an actual physical, you know, manipulation of real chemistry. So this entire tool set, in fact, UC Berkeley, it's my old alma mater, they're right down the road from here, they were one of the first universities to really sort of develop this BioBrick protocol, which is now being used around the world for all kinds of things. And I have to start also by saying that just like many other tools of science, the positive side of this kind of recombinant proteomics and being able to manipulate genetic material has spectacular potential for solving problems like curing cancer. And
good or bad,
diseases.
Right?
I mean, there's a really strong positive side to it. But the flip side says that the exact same tools and the exact same technology can also make some very horrible, I mean truly horrible, bioweapons. And so just, again, just a little more history, if I may.
Well, and let me ask you this, though,
please,
Charles, because we're coming up to the break here.
Sure, okay, go ahead.
If I'm hearing you right,
yes,
it sounds like you're saying you believe that whatever's going on out there in Germany and elsewhere could have been manufactured in a lab.
Oh, absolutely. There's no question. I don't have any hard data that says it was. But if I were planning to test the epidemiological characteristics to characterize the spread rate, and you look at certain characteristics, the population density, the particular social situation, there's a bunch of variables that sort of mix together. Then you say, okay, what if ... And then you actually release an organism just to see what those characteristics are and how closely they match the model. So if one were to plan a more serious biological threat of some kind, you would start by having these sort of test procedures. And that is completely normal. In fact, it's been done before in cases where the United States has also had a few of these tests in the past. We know quite well that in earlier times, there were populations here in the United States, even in San Francisco, where they were trying sort of mild versions of flu and this sort of thing just to see how far it spread, what take to calm it down.
And Charles, does E. coli replicate itself and spread out, or do you have to have it on, let's say, 10,000 cucumbers and that's it? It stays on 10,000 cucumbers.
Well, yes and no. Here's the deal about this. E. coli is one of the most common organisms on the planet. I mean, it is like the de facto, you know, generic bacteria. It's everywhere. Now, right here in California, we had a couple of incidents where we had some infected spinach, and we had some infected sprouts. I remember they had to recall so many tons of spinach that actually came from a quote-unquote organic farm, and they claimed in that case that because of the fact that the water that was being used to irrigate the spinach had come from a nearby farm where there was live pigs and apparently fecal matter had gotten into the water, et cetera. At least that's
hold on for a second, Charles. We're going to hit the break. We'll be right back. We'll talk with you more about this incredible story, and we'll take your calls. Well, next hour, Roger Tulsis joins us as we talk about electronic harassment spying on us. When we come back, we'll take some calls and continue talking with Charles Ostman about the E. coli situation in Europe. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. Charles, let's let you finish up a little bit about this overview. We'll take some calls and a few more questions for you. Go ahead.
Sure. Well, and just to back off, just not just from E. coli, but if I may, just branch out to a slightly broader range because, in fact, in my mind, and I've actually sat in a number of these sort of policy sessions when we look at these different kinds of potential threats and how and why and that sort of thing. And as a comparison, for instance, most people think that the next big thing might be a nuclear event, either a dirty bomb or, heaven forbid, even a fission explosion. But both of those kinds of events, terrible as they are, they have a known signature to them. Whatever the collateral damage is, there's a kind of a range of possibilities, and you can confine the damage, and you sort of have a timeline that you can work with. The problem with these biologicals is, let's say with somebody designed not just the E. coli, but something much more horrific, which would actually be more of a viral type of situation, and I think that's really where the real danger is going to come in, because the ability to build viruses that can be like stealth viruses, you wouldn't really know what they are, and there are ways that they're now combinatorial, kind of almost like prion-like objects where they can be dormant and then in your bloodstream or in your physiology, and then something later comes along that sort of activates the pathological aspects of it. That kind of combinatorial quasi-viral approach, I think, might be the next thing around the corner. But in terms of strategic threat analysis, the problem with it is that you don't know what things it can mutate into. In other words, viruses are the most mutational objects that exist that we know of. They constantly change, and in fact, everything mutates constantly. But if there was a group of people out there, for whatever reason, whatever their agenda might be, who didn't particularly care about the kinds of diplomatic or sort of national treaty kind of world that we once lived in, didn't care if the thing mutated or caused some kind of damage just for their own reasons, could in fact unleash something that would be much worse than E. coli. So in a way, these are kind of like wake-up calls. And in my mind, in fact, I work with a company right now, and we're very big on food security. That's an issue that I take very seriously. Even if this wasn't a purposely invoked event, it certainly suggests that the potential exists. And of all the different areas that we have examined, I mean, there's different delivery mechanisms and different ways to deliver biopathogens. Certainly using food as a platform is right at the very top of the list. So, I mean, it clearly shows the pattern that if one were to test this process, you would start with something like this that is relatively mild, but it sort of paves the way to examine the like I said, the epidemiological characteristics of how something vastly more serious could be implemented. And these are like the test procedures to see how it would work out and what the response. And one other thing I should point out, in the world of pathogen detection, how this normally works, and there's some areas I won't go into because it's kind of quasi-classified, but the general idea is we have a sort of like a catalog of all the known genotypes and genetic types that we're looking for. We know what the DNA patterns would be for certain types of things that we're already aware of. The scary part is if we encounter something that's new, that is not part of the genetic catalog that we know of, then you have to spend much more time trying to figure out exactly what it is and what the pathogenic properties are. And what a virus does is it actually enters the cells through enzymic action. Like a hand to a glove, a virus looks for a particular kind of cell, whatever it might be, and then once it's lashed on that cell, it can ooze its way into the cytoplasm and glom onto the ribosome and other parts and force the cells to replicate more viruses. So it's a self-replicating piece of machinery. So that's actually a much more dangerous kind of thing because,
sure,
like I said, if it's inert and there's no real effect and it's just sort of in your system, and then later some other component comes along that activates it, you could have a truly horrific pandemic on a grand scale. So to me, looking at this whole agenda of how to prepare for and how to deal with these kinds of outbreaks, I think is really interesting. The swine flu incidents and these other events that were coming out of Asia, that actually is much scarier to me than these E. coli events. And I say that for a reason. As you recall, when the Soviet Union was collapsing, and there was this point in time where people, both the U.S. and others, China specifically, were busily harvesting all the various Soviet scientists they could. And kind of like Project Paperclip right after World War II, it was very similar. There were a lot of people who were coming out of the labs in Kazakhstan, and I've actually met with Dr. Ken Alibek a number of times. He was the supreme director of biological warfare for the Soviet Union before he came here and defected. But if you've ever read the book Biohazard, it goes into great detail about just how much of a program they had. And it was, they were quite aggressive about this. And their particular thing was producing huge amounts of Hunter virus, a hemorrhagic fever, that they could put into aerosol dispersant. And then they had a whole plan already designed for this. So whatever remnants of those labs that others may have gotten their hands on, whether it's the actual material or, much more importantly, those scientists, and God knows who could have employed them, but the whole point is it was a kind of a free-for-all, and we don't know where some of those scientists are now. And these would be the exact kind of people, perhaps funded by Chinese or somebody else with those sorts of interests, who could be absolutely putting together a very much more sophisticated kind of viral system with these ideas in mind. And that's kind of where I think the larger danger is. In the context of how do you respond to this, the thing that I would suggest to the audience is that I think food safety is a priority we should be looking at. And I happen to work for a company that manufactures specialized hydroponic equipment, because in this context, you control everything. You control the water.
But Charles, let me ask you this.
Yes, please.
And we got to take some calls. Lining up.
Yeah.
Why Germany? If this was dropped on them, and I think it might have been. Too weird. It's too strange.
Fine,
Why Germany?
Because that's a perfect place to. It's a major Western country. It's a perfect kind of demographic. If you're gonna, it's a model just like the United States. If you're gonna try to launch a test of this kind of process, that's where you would go. You go to a major, modern, industrialized country where they have a sort of a typical Western style of community.
All right, it's like Wichita. If it works
exactly.
in Wichita, it's going to work all over the place.
Exactly. So, I mean, if I had to choose a range of models to work with, I would want to simulate as closely as possible what my eventual real targets would be.
All right, we'll take some calls here as we continue chatting with Charles Ostman. You've heard what he thinks. Let's go to Tom, Port Angeles, Washington, west of the Rockies. Hey, Tom, go ahead. Thanks for calling.
Hello, George. Thanks for taking my call. Charles, you got a really interesting topic going on here. And one of the things we got to look at in food processing and food handling, right, is the opportunities that people have from unskilled labor or people that have been placed in unskilled labor, right, to go ahead and distribute this stuff along the harvesting, the processing, the cleaning. There's all these phases food goes through
Correct.
Before it goes out, okay?
That's exactly right.
Right?
Yeah.
So, you know, why it's kind of like an Occam's razor thing. It's kind of like we seem to make an effort to ignore the people who are propagating such stuff and doing such stuff and look for other things to look at. I think that stuff like this, particularly in relative to a case in Oregon where they found not only one but three different strains of E. coli in one group, right? I think it was in Oregon or Washington State. I'm not sure. That's where I live, right?
Well, we had a big event here in California as well. So, yeah, I'm certainly aware of these kinds of events.
Okay, so why not look first at you know, the people in the companies and the the producers who are, for the lack of a better expression, of Islamic radical bent. Okay.
Well, I see where you're going with this, and that's kind of why I made mention of the company I currently work for, because I think that we could do a lot to minimize the amount of steps it takes to get food from one place to another, and the amount of the handling, and just the way you talked about. Your points are exactly right, and I think that we should take a very different approach in what you might call the value chain or the process chain of how food is actually produced and in bulk and put in the stores and so forth. That's the one area where the security is almost non-existent. And even though there are regulations, and I've studied all these, you know, bureaucratic requirements being organic and so on. Most of that stuff is just paper. It's not really how it's actually done in this field. I'm quite aware of this. And in my mind, somewhere in the future, and I hopefully inspire people to look at this idea, we may want to switch to a different kind of farming where I think this whole idea of these huge factory farms where you're spraying pesticides and you're trying to inoculate the soil with these various chemicals to force them to grow, and you grow these plants that look pretty but they have almost no nutrient value whatsoever, is also an open season for anyone that wants to, in fact, put these kinds of microbes into the crops on purpose. That's where the weak link in the chain is. And if we changed the method of how we produce our food, I think this is a big piece of a puzzle that's missing in our overall plan. So, I mean, I agree with you. And I'm working on some of these problems as we speak. Now, can it be scaled up to the point where we can service a very large community or majority of our crops as we grow them now? I think over time this can be done, but I think we really do need to change the entire process, and that's kind of a tall order, but in trying to answer the problem, is there a solution? There is a solution, or a solution set, I should say, but it would require kind of a really different approach to how we do farming now, and I would certainly agree with that.
I wonder if some company's going to come out and say, we now have an E. coli-resistant genetically modified food.
Well, I'm sure there's some problem. I mean, a lot of the GMOs were designed specifically to retard various kinds of microbes and or other kinds of, you know, predatory insects and that kind of thing. And it's like whack-a-mole. The minute you do this kind of modification, then some other kind of entity comes along, and also the food itself. Again, when you start playing around with this kind of modification, the sort of unexpected consequences of other organisms suddenly mutating and adapting to the new whatever the situation is. Biology is almost like weather in a way. It's a very chaotic system. It doesn't stay stagnant. It's not linear. And that's why I get really nervous when people start talking about these kinds of ideas, because you don't know what the long-term consequences are.
No.
And at the same time, when you have people like Monsanto, for instance, that now want to patent, you know, entire DNA strains and force farmers to use only their particular seeds and that kind of thing, that sets a precedent for a very dangerous future where you severely limit the range of food types that are out there. And that, in my mind, is in itself a subject which we can go into. But, I mean, it's going in the wrong direction. The right direction is to change the process of how the food is produced, not in this kind of genetic solution or that sort of thing. I think we want to be changing the actual farming process itself.
Let's go to Robin in Oakland, California on the wild card line. Robin, welcome to the program. Hi there. Go ahead, Robin.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Happy belated birthday, Mr. Norris.
Oh, thank you. Go ahead.
All of a sudden, you popped on so quickly. What I wanted to ask was, is there do you see a financial relationship between the H1 or this the virus that's occurring and where it's occurring? Do you recall the H1N1?
Yeah, I absolutely.
The non-pandemic.
Yes, exactly right.
Right, the non-pandemic that wiped out millions of chickens and birds, and who benefited financially from it?
Well, and that's another topic, because that's where I was actually going to go. The whole idea of warfare being, you know, soldiers with guns and tanks and shooting each other, that's kind of passe. That's a very different world we live in now, and actually economic warfare is really the front line of what's happening in today's strategic sort of outlay. And you're exactly right. And this idea of causing harm to another country's economy, their social stability, as a way to make them more vulnerable to sort of unfavorable trade agreements or whatever else, you know, trying to get access to the resources, whatever it might be, that exactly is the sort of thing that would be used for that context. That, in fact, is another item in the list of things that we have been researching in our think tanks. That's exactly the kind of stuff that could happen, and causing massive crop failures or causing panic where people begin to, you know, act strangely or differently and change their buying patterns and that whole thing. Absolutely. The economic consequence, this goes far beyond just causing harm to people. In fact, that causing harm to people is sort of like the top end of the pyramid. But layers below that, causing harm to the economy, is absolutely part of that kind of strategic overview that really does have a potential effect to change the power structure between the you know, as we see the shift of the economic epicenters of the world shifting from the west to the east, that's kind of how I see it, and a lot of my comrades see it the same way. These kinds of incidents would be just the sort of thing to kind of nudge that direction and keep it going in that momentum. And I think, once again, those were test runs. The intent wasn't really just to kill off a lot of chickens or cause, you know, death on a certain scale. It was to study the epidemiological aspects of how these things could be done so that in the future something much more virulent could be sort of replicated and with the same procedure but on a much larger scale.
Let's go to Chicago. Hey, John, welcome to the program. Go ahead, John.
Jonah, hi, Georgie.
Hi.
I talked to you several months ago. It's always a pleasure to hear your voice.
Thank you.
By the way, I saw you on a television clip when they were talking about the Indian mounds throughout the United States.
Yes.
You're a pretty good-looking guy, George.
Eh, not bad.
Okay.
Face for radio, but not bad.
Okay. Here's my question. I've been listening to your honored guest, Charles, talking about, for lack of a better description, biological warfare, spreading of viruses, and, you know, by bad people and this and that, what could happen. However, yeah. I believe I heard Charles say, which really disturbs me, he glossed over an example of, the flu was dispersed, or various strains of flu were dispersed. I think you said California, maybe somewhere.
No, we had an E. coli outbreak here. Now, in past times, going back 25 years ago, it was a known fact that, in fact, there were some mild versions of flu that were dispensed just to see what the spread would be, and it was. Nobody
just
died or anything, but it was a test. It was a part of a biological test.
Well, wait, here's my question.
Okay,
just to see.
Yeah.
Just to see, some of you're telling me, the audience, that somebody just dispersed the flu virus or whatever on an unknowing public just to see what would happen? Isn't that terrorism, sir?
Well, the objective, and I'm not defending any of this. Believe me, I had nothing to do with any of this.
They didn't tell us, Charles.
Yes,
that's
exactly
the thing.
Right.
That's
the point was, at that time, in a much earlier time, when the when there was no modeling, there was no way to really test except to simply go out in the field and see what happens. In today's world, of course, this is done through simulations and through much more sophisticated means. But in an earlier time, these things did happen. And I'm not defending any of this. Believe me, I'm not part of that world. I'm not defending those policies at all. But there was a known history back in the 50s and 60s when this sort of thing did, in fact, happen.
Well, we know they did spraying of biologicals in St. Louis. They did it over Navy ships with sailers.
It happened here in San Francisco.
Yeah.
There was an outbreak in San Francisco. I mean, it's a known history. Now, just to give a kind of a comparison, and I say this with extreme care because a lot of my friends are Russians and I don't want to make this sound in the wrong way, but back in the Soviet Union days, their take on, or their sort of policy on collateral damage versus exploring new weaponry technology or whatever you might want to call it, they had a very different attitude about safety or sort of collateral consequences than we did. We were actually pretty careful to give a comparison. But in the Soviet Union, when they had accidents or things that went awry, especially out in Kazakhstan where Dr. Vyalbek's lab was, some of their experiments went very, very badly. And if you've ever read the book Biohazard, which is a pretty good read, the stuff that's not in the book is truly frightening. Now, of course, we have had some accidents. Everybody knows about the Dugway facility in Utah. That's the major bio-research testing facility. And there's others elsewhere in the country I won't mention. But we've been relatively careful. It's a matter of comparison. In other parts of the world, much worse things happen. I'll just put it that way.
Well, and this is a situation, Charles, that I'm afraid is not going to go away. It's going to get worse. Now they're talking about contaminated cucumbers again. They don't know what it is. I think you're right on. I think Steve Quayle is as well. And then my suspicions that there's something else afoot here. I'll be back in a moment. Roger Tulsis joining us. Electronic harassment. Do they know what you're thinking? We'll be back.